And we're continuing an interview with Richard Thu in Cove, Oregon. It is still Monday, December 12, 2005. So, getting back to what we were just talking about at the end of the last side there of the tape, basically, you have to teach to a test.
And when there's a standardized test.
And you, if I have this right, your feeling was it wasn't fair to either the student or the teacher.
No, it just depends on a teacher when they test their students, test on whatever it is they've covered.
Right.
And in covering history, for instance, I might be talking about what John Adams did during the forming of our nation, and a student asks a question, and I get off on the relationship between Jefferson and Adams, and you know that's not on the test. And so those students, when they get to the test and that's not covered, well, they're in a bad spot. But if I'm testing them, then I'm going to ask a question about it because I know that I covered that. And that's generally the way you test in a classroom. So to me, that makes a standardized testing suspect. And it's not so bad in something like math, because math is math. And you're going to learn to add, subtract, multiply, and divide, the algebraic formulas, and all of that, so you can be fairly sure that teachers will cover a certain area. Some students may get farther than others, but what led up to that is going to be basically the same in all schools.
So do you think that the SIM and the CAM are trends? Or trends, or do you think those will change or be dropped eventually?
I think they're almost dropped now. Now, like I said, I haven't been teaching for 2 years, and so my ear hasn't been to the ground as much as it was, but they will be modified and essentially be gone. Now, one of the other things we went through was behavioral objectives, where everything that you did had to be couched in behavioral objective terms. And that wasn't so bad. I mean, you could do that. But it wasn't 5 years and people forgot about behavioral objectives. Not that those kind of objectives weren't used. It's just the fact that being required to use them was a lot different than just using them naturally. So those things change. And I'm supervising some student teachers now for Eastern. And that's been a lot of fun. And one of the things that some of them are learning is using the new technology. And instead of using an overhead to write on there, they've got, in Cove anyway, they've got a projector hanging from the ceiling that projects on a big screen, and the instructor's in the back of the room writing, or he can be anywhere in the room, actually, and writing on a tablet that shows up on the screen, which is a really neat instrument. In fact, I wanted to get one of those for a long time.
Uh-huh.
They finally got a grant that enabled them purchase those.
Is that what they call the equipment they use in a smart classroom?
I'm not familiar with that term, but it might be in.
I think that's what they call it on campus when they have all of that new technology in the classroom. I think they call it a smart classroom, but I've only just begun to hear that.
Yeah, very well may be, and it certainly would match that description, because you have all kinds of electronics that you can use. And some of that's good and some of it's not. I was just reading something that they're beginning to question a student research on when they Google something or whatever, that they might get a page out of a book on John Adams and use that for a reference. But they miss those pages that led up to it and the pages that follow it. And consequently, they're not getting the whole picture when they do that. It's a lot easier just to call up that one page, you know, and get that information. But they miss reading the whole book. It may give them a wider range of education, in that by having that research so readily available, they can do a lot more research in different areas. But I think it's a lot more shallow.
Let's talk about a typical day in the classroom, but let's talk about it over time. In other words, I want to talk about basically your work day. You know, when you go through, there must be a lot of differences in that from when you began here to when you retired a couple of years ago.
Yeah, there were. Looking at it as a student, when I came here in the big school, of course, things were pretty formal. And, you know, you had pretty much multiple choice tests and that sort of thing. And I remember we had a split class in English when I was a senior at Cove, where there was one teacher for both the juniors and the seniors at the same time. And the juniors were in one room and the seniors were across the hall, so the teacher went back and forth between them. Well, that means that one group or the other was left alone a lot. And we would be working on, say, a term paper. I still remember that I wrote my term paper on the Anopheles mosquito, the carrier of malaria. But I also remember that we would send one person across the street to the store to use class money to buy us all an ice cream.
When the teacher was gone to the other room?
Yeah.
Now, this is when you were a student.
Yeah, that's when I was a senior.
Uh-huh.
And you know, those things didn't happen when I was a teacher. Although Cove still runs a very informal school, and which is the way I like it. That's an open campus, and it varies from classroom to classroom and from administrator to administrator, but sometimes kids are allowed to have something to drink in the classroom. They usually sometimes limited to water, sometimes they can go and get a cup of hot chocolate or something. And when we're having an informal discussion or watching a movie, there'll be kids maybe sitting on the desks rather than in the desks, you know, and things like that still reflect the informality of a rural school. As far as the typical day, one of the major differences that I've seen is that students today would rather socialize. If they're given 15 minutes to get their homework done, they would rather socialize in the classroom and then get their work done at home. Whereas I think over the years it's changed. It used to be that if you had time to get it done in the classroom, you wanted to get it done in the classroom because when you went home, you wanted to do something else. But this is, I think, a social change in how the kids react. And that's one thing that that teachers have to fight against, because it penalizes the poor students, because they don't want to be left out of the socialization. And consequently, they're trying to do their work at home, and one of the reasons they're a poorer student may be that they live in a small house, and dad has a TV going, and there's no place for them to study, and little brother's coming in, and, you know, all kinds of problems. Or they come from a family where there's a lot of farm work to do. Well, we don't have a lot of farm families anymore. We do have ranchette farms where you guys will feed the horses and, you know, whatever. And so I think students, I think teachers have to realize that the poor students are at a disadvantage then if they don't have time to do it at home. So they come back the next day not having done their work. Whereas the students who have their own room, their own computer, their own whatever, you know, are able to get the work done at home, and they can socialize at school. So that's always a balance that you have to do. I never liked to be a taskmaster where, you know, I whipped them into shape all the time and make sure their nose was to the grindstone. For one reason, I feel that that's a lesson that they have to learn, and that they have to discipline themselves. So I would encourage them to do that. I would not let them get out of line, but I also allowed some conversation going. So that's one major change. And another one, I suppose, is extracurricular activities. I think there's a lot more of that today. I think that's good, because one of the major factors in junior, senior high school is what you learn about yourself and what, you know, how you develop personally. That's the most important thing that goes on. I mean, anybody can learn, you know, what's in the Constitution, but learning about yourself is unique and something that's vital to the rest of your life. And I think you learn a lot by doing extracurricular activities, whether it be band or football or track or whatever it might be. Different clubs go on, and bigger schools, of course. Smaller schools, you don't have as much choice. If everybody doesn't go out for football, well, you may not have a football team. You don't have enough kids, and so on. So there's pressure to be involved when you might not have been involved in a bigger school. But then on the other hand, you don't cut anybody in a small school. So if you come out for football, you're on the team. You may not be a starter, you may not play a lot or whatever, but you're still part of what's going on. And I, you know, I think that's good. In my coaching, I coach both football and track. I also coach tennis when I first started out with that. You know, I saw a lot of things that help students learn to do things that they never dreamed that they could do, learn that hard work pays off, learn about caring about your teammates, all those things that happen on the field, I think, are very important. And students today are a lot more involved in those extracurricular activities than they used to be.
How about trends in communication? Like, say, obviously computers have perhaps reduced outright paperwork for the teacher, but maybe brought on other burdens that weren't there before. And also about communicating with parents. now versus when you began?
Well, there's a lot of that that's just on the verge of being used. Now, for instance, down here at Cope, if you want to know to some extent what your student is doing, you can go on the school website, and if the teacher has posted some work, you can find out what they're working on at this time, maybe even homework. But for most teachers, it's pretty hard to every day put the homework for each class on the website. That is extra work. That's not easy. But I think a lot of them do that, and that was not available when I was teaching. But that certainly can help a parent. But what I've heard most of the teachers say is that they question how many parents use that. And, you know, obviously there are still households that don't have computers. And so that, you know, that really hasn't changed in that they don't have that extra communication. Certainly telephones, cell phones and all that have made it easier to communicate with teachers and students, and that's good. But I think that's that hasn't changed that much, I guess. That it's a function of how much somebody wants to communicate, whether it's a parent or a teacher, rather than the tools they have to use. And I found over the years that communicating with parents, it's more likely the good student parents who are going to communicate. Which, of course, are the ones who don't need them. And you have an open house night when teachers can come. I mean, parents can come and go through the classes, for instance, in the high school. Now, it's different in grade school. But in the high school, you have, out of a class of 20, you might have 7 or 8 sets of parents. And they would be probably the top. Occasionally you would get in. One of the things that we instituted at Cove that I think has been an absolute wonderful thing is that it's what I call a student study team, SST. And this meeting can be called by the student, by the parent, by the teacher, by the administrator, anybody who's involved with the student. And it's a meeting of all the students, teachers, the parents, and the student. And one of the great things that have come out of this is that a student's having a problem. A lot of times they're having the same problem in all their classes, but you don't know that. And so this is one way that gets communicated. And a student is sitting there, and there's teachers there who are saying, basically, we want to help you. And a light bulb comes on for those kids sometimes. And they say, hey, you know, these people aren't here to torture me. They're here to help me. You know, the teacher knows that, but, some of them might torture them. It certainly is a... one way that you can get through that. Now, this also replaced the quote-unquote punishment of athletes, too. That if an athlete in some schools is having trouble, well, then they can't be on a team. Well, with the SST, they develop a plan, and that plan might be, we're going to hold you off the team for a week. Now, they don't do that very often. And I'm sure they have, but very seldom here at Cove. And because they've developed the plan, and they have a reporting system that they develop, and it's different for every student, although there may be some elements the same. The student knows what they're supposed to do, and the teachers follow through with what they're supposed to do, and whatever the problem is, you know, it's help. So it's been that kind of thing has been a real change, where it used to be just between an individual teacher may or may not call parents, and parents may or may not be concerned enough to come to school and find out what's going on. And certainly students, many of them are directed by what's the least amount of work that can do. And some of them are directed by feeling very inadequate and behind classwork for a lot of different reasons. So I think that's been helpful.
Now, you said that you served on the school board here in Cove. When was that? How long did you do that?
I was on school board for 2 years, from 80 to 82. Of course, when I was elected to school board, I had no idea that I was in 2 years going to want to teach. But that's the way it worked out. And in my government classes that I taught, I always tried to help the students understand that they owe something to their community. And the school has followed up on that philosophy by having graduation requirements that they have to do a certain amount of community service, and they have some kind of what's loosely called a senior project, although it can be a several-year project, in which they, people have done everything from planting an area right across from the school, kind of a decoration in a part of the new road when they put it in that was just going to be nothing, and that belonged to anybody, and they made it so it's low upkeep, and planted some different kinds of plants that didn't take much, and rocked in a lot of it so that when weeds growing up in there. Another student painted a mural in one of the school rooms, all around the room. It took her more than 2 years to complete. Some of them work on their cars, some of them do other things. But anyway, I've always told them, encouraged them to find out what they can do, whether they serve as a volunteer fireman, serve on city council. I've been the mayor in Cove for 20 years. Okay. I think 20 years. And, that's the way I saw that I could serve. And so I've encouraged students wherever they go find out how they can.
Now, were you the mayor even when you were teaching?
Oh, yeah.
Let's go back here. We forgot about the school board. So you got on the school board, and you did you resign midterm? Was your term longer when you
was
teaching?
Yeah, it was 4 years. A woman who ran for the school board at the same time I did, we were concerned about what was going on with the school board, because we attended school board meetings as members of the community, and I remember, sitting in the meeting for 45 minutes and nothing was said because nobody wanted to be the one to put their opinions forward. They were just kind of afraid of each other or something, or public, or I don't know. And their meetings would go on till 1 o'clock in the morning. And so we ran on the campaign that we wanted to, and they would have several meetings a month, where instead of just one, and we said, we're going to get business done, and we're going to meet once a month, and we're going to be done at 10 o'clock. And so both of us were elected. And
this was your campaign platform?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, as much as you have, right, in a small town. I don't know that, I'm sure people didn't elect us for that reason. That was just things that we talked about. But we took that on. At that time, we were getting about a 50% turnover in faculty every year. And one of our goals was to stop that, find ways to encourage good teachers to stay. And we did that. Our salary schedule was about the lowest in the state at the time, which is one reason we got. And so we found ways of raising the salary schedule and attracting more teachers. And since that time, whether that was just the start of it or just happened, I don't know, but we've had a very experienced staff here, a very stable staff, where if we lost two teachers a year, that was quite a few. And usually we didn't lose any, because our salary is probably in the middle of the pack now. And it's a good place to work. It's not teacher against administrator, teacher against the board. It's more, let's see what we can do as a team to do a good job.
What were some of the specific duties of the school board? We've mentioned some of them around the periphery.
Yeah.
Hiring faculty.
But I went to the Oregon School Board Association. Puts on a new school board member clinic. And that clinic is designed to teach the basics to a new school board member. And one of the things that impressed me when I went to it, not all new school board members go to it, I encourage them to go. That's what always happens. And when I went to it, one of the things that they really made a point of was that the school board's job is to decide policy. The administration's job is to carry that policy out. And if you're going to have an administrator, you better hire one that you can trust to do the job. That doesn't mean that you don't ask questions about how money's being spent and, that sort of thing. But you don't say, well, wait a minute, this teacher doesn't need 10 pairs of scissors. They only need 7 pairs. The school board shouldn't be doing that. They should make a policy that says the teachers should have an adequate supply of scissors. And so a school board member's job is not to micromanage, but to set basic policy about how things are functioning. And to hire an administrator, a superintendent, that is going to get the job.
So you, one of your contributions was improving the retention rate of teachers and paying them a little bit better than when you came onto the board. Were there any other major accomplishments of the board during your tenure there?
One thing I always like to point to, because it's one of those where I told you so. we at the time I shifted from being a school board to being a teacher. Just before I left the school board, they debated the athletic policy. And basically the athletic policy was you break the rules, you're gone. And of course drinking was part of that. But this is a rural community, and every one of those board members probably had a beer when they were in high school and so on. And so a board, you know, they don't want to say that's absolutely, you know, the death penalty if you drink, but rather they want to say, kids will make mistakes, and so we need to deal with that mistake. But the board at this time decided that you're gone if you break the rules, and one of the rules was you don't drink. Well, we had a, when we passed that rule, the next year I started teaching and coaching football. I was an assistant coach, and we had a good team. In fact, the next 10 years we went to the state championship 7 times, and that was a year that we ended up being the state champion. And we had a bye week early on, and the other coach.
And we're continuing the interview with Richard Thu. It is December 12, 2005. So in the previous side, before the tape ended, we talked about while you were on the school board, they had developed this athletic policy that involved zero tolerance, and you went to another school to do some observing. That's what
we talked about. Yeah, and I should have said beforehand that when we passed this athletic policy, I was the no vote, and I said, you got to have a policy with forgiveness. A student needs to be able to earn their way back. Maybe you miss a game, maybe you miss 2 games, maybe you do something, but you need to be able to work your way back and show that you have learned from your mistake and have grown from. Oh no, boy, they grew up, we're kicking them off. So, that next fall, during football, we had gone down to Prairie City to do some scouting, and a group of the players went down too in a car. Well, one of the players came from a family where the refrigerator in the garage was always full of beer, and parents didn't care. Kid went out there and had a beer. Well, and when they went to go down there, he grabbed a 6-pack and took that with him. Well, silly kids on the way back. Outside of Baker was a place where they weigh trucks, and they were stopping people there who had been in the forest getting firewood, check their permits and everything. Well, a car didn't have to stop, but these kids stopped because they think you're supposed to. And so the sheriff or state police guy that was there smelled the beer or something. The driver had not been drinking. They were that smart. But there were 6 of them in the car and 6 beers. So, you know, they weren't loaded or anything. But here they get an MIP. Well, on this policy, they were gone. And, of course, they were all upperclassmen, all important to the team and so
all
on.
6 of them.
6 of them.
All 6 got suspended or booted?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so here's the state championship team, and the board says, well, wait a minute, we can't kick all these guys off. You know. And so they have an emergency meeting, back off their policy, and made the kids so write a letter of apology, and, you know, I don't know what else they did. But that I remember that so vividly because that was my chance to say I told you so. You know, but of course I didn't because I was working for him.
Right. Were there any other episodes like that when you were on the board?
No, not that I recall. We did, 1 year later on, I remember we had a pretty good basketball team and they were going to the state tournament and two of the kids got caught smoking. And the policy then was a little more flexible, but they were caught the day before the game, you know, and so there wasn't much they could do but hold them off for a game, and of course he lost. But in general, that's my philosophy with, maybe that comes from my church background, I don't know, but I believe people have a chance to redeem themselves and have a chance to show that they learn. And I think that's the best for kids.
How many people serve on the Cove School Board?
I think there's five.
Are they compensated?
No. None of the local political governmental positions are compensated.
So what would be the incentive then to be on the school board?
Well, I think basically to serve your community, you know, that we all owe something to the community, and people who feel like they can serve on the school board do that.
Now, we're going to talk about your mayor background in just a moment, but did you hold any other local offices or community service positions in the area out here over the years?
No, I was on the school board, and then I've been mayor. And
you did two years of the 4-year term on the school board, and that's right. The only time on that particular body.
Correct.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the mayorship then. When were you first elected mayor?
I think it was 85, but I'm not real sure about that, to tell you the truth.
I've
never looked it up to see what year it was.
And you did this, you've done this while you also taught school.
Yeah. So the mayor's job is not a big time consuming job. You know, you can really put into it as much time as you want. And our city government is what is called the weak mayor system. So the mayor doesn't have a lot of extra duties like Tom Potter in Portland does, you know. I run the meetings and sign the checks and that's about it. I go to other meetings representing the city, but I don't have any more influence over what happens than, in fact, I don't have as much because I don't vote in the council unless there's a tie. We have six council members, so sometimes that happens. Very seldom. We use a modified system of Robert's Rules of Order. We're informal, and we generally discuss an issue before we make a motion. And so when the motion's made, it's usually made in the direction that most people are going to vote anyway. So, you know, if we have a negative vote, it's 5-1. I do become a voting member if there are only three council members there, and we need four for the quorum. But that happens seldom.
Is the mayor position compensated?
No.
I assume that they provide for travel if necessary.
Yeah, if I'm being sent to a meeting or something, or anybody else for that matter, if it's overnight, they'll pay for housing and meals and travel. We, the city government here, you know, is obviously very small. We don't, our budget is very low, and so on. The big thing that's happened in the 20 years that I've been here, just before I became mayor, they started a project which was to build a power plant up on Mill Creek, where there was an old one before. And during the 80s, the policy that was the federal policy was that we want to diversify the power grid so that all the power isn't coming from one source. And so they passed this law that said if the nearest municipality to a hydro possibility, I guess I'd say, has first dibs on developing that policy or that the project. And since there, when we moved here in 57, this power plant was still operating up there, but later on it was taken out. And some people got together and said, hey, well, why don't we do this? And they did it on revenue bonds, so it didn't cost any tax money. Revenue bond is, of course, paid off. The money is loaned and then paid off by the income from the plant. We sell our electricity to the local power company, which is OPEC now, was CP National then. And we had a 20-year contract, which is up now, but it was extended due to repairs we had to make. And also the man who engineered the plant for us made some serious mistakes and disappeared. We never did find him, so we never could collect on his bond or anything. But the plant was supposed to produce 900 kilowatts per hour and only produces about 600. And we know why, but it would cost a lot to fix it. So we just have been happy with 600, although it has cost us at different times, but due to how it was set up. But we pay it off this year, or next year rather, and then for 2 years we'll have a real decent income from it. All the money's been so far, besides upkeep and salaries, it has money's all gone into paying for the bond. And the idea that the federal government put forward this time was that we decentralize, and this will allow electrical companies to avoid having to build a dam or a coal-fired plant or a nuclear plant or whatever. So because they're saving money, they can pay these hydro plants or cogeneration plants more than what they would pay normally. And so the contracts were put on an escalator so that our income from the plant keeps going up. And they pay us probably twice as much as what they sell the electricity for. So companies like OTEC don't like this kind of contract because they never were going to build a power plant or build a dam, because they're just a line company. They just move electricity from one point to another. And so it really didn't save them anything. And you may have read about the fact that OTEC is lowering their rates 16% started the first of the year, because their contract with the cogeneration plant in Prairie City has just run out, and it's been costing them a lot. We're just a drop in the bucket. 600 kilowatts is nothing. But the plant in Prairie City was producing, I don't know, 25% of their electricity or something. 25%, you know. But a lot, anyway. And so it was costing them quite a bit of money. And so they were happy to have that contract run out. The plant at Prairie City will now sell their electricity for a lot less. I don't know whether they're selling it to OTEC or whether they're selling it to Idaho Power or wherever. We'll be in that position in a couple of years where we'll have to find a buyer for our power. And that's been a lot of work, you know, because here's a bunch of guys who, you know, what do we know about power plants? And so you have to trust people that you're working with, number one. And number two, you have to do a lot of education of, you know, what goes on, and you have to find a city worker who can understand what goes on up there, and that's hard enough because, you know, we don't, you're not going to get rich being the public works director of Cove. It's not there, and so you know, our choices, we've been really lucky. We've had some good ones. Mike Brown, who's our public works director now, he is just top notch, you know. That's been good, but it hasn't been easy. We don't have a lot of controversy. The biggest controversy I can remember was at one time when the old tavern had been taken out. And before this new one was built, the guy who had taken the old one out wanted to start one where the beauty salon is next to the post office. Some people objected to that. They said, too close to school, you know, never mind that here is sold right across the street from the school. And so protested the granting of a license, and so we held a hearing, and the room that we hold our meetings in was packed, but there were only about two people who were against it, and the rest were for it. So that ended the controversy.
Have there been any other major events or changes during your term of office over the years?
As far as the city's concerned?
As far as the city goes, we talked about the electrical plant, which sounds like it has brought in revenue for the city.
Yeah, we'll have some money to spend on some projects. In fact, we're right now discussing what kind of projects we want to spend the money on. Because it'll be a substantial piece of money, so we're looking forward to being able to do some things. Probably when we get done spending that money is probably when I'll retire. I put in 20 years of, you know, getting that thing to be paid off. I want to have a hand in doing some projects with the money.
Right.
As far as other things are concerned, there hasn't been any really major things. When the state came through and redid the highway and put in sidewalks and so on, that was a big deal. We've put in a new water system this last year, a new well, and while that should have not been eventful, it was, because the well driller that we hired was I don't want to get sued for saying he was incompetent, so I would say he had some problems, and so that was a hassle. We had to go to arbitration and all that, and we got the well finished, and it's in line, and it's very good. It's in the same aquifer that Artesian Blue gets their water from, and it's sold all over the And so that's real nice. And, in the 80s, we put in a sewer plant down here, and we're doing a plan right now to upgrade that, because Cove sits on tons of water. Everywhere you go in the area, you know, there's water, either irrigation ditches or little springs. Or I had a hole open up in my garden out here one time about this big around it that all of a sudden gushed water out of it. I'm sure it was runoff from the rain, you know, and that sort of thing, but that's the way it is here. And because of that water that's everywhere, we get a lot of extra water in our sewer ponds, which pushes them to capacity. So we're our next project will be to put in a some kind of sewer upgrade. We're talking about maybe doing a wetlands project like LeGrand has out in Plaid Marsh. I really like that idea, and I've been pushing that. But there are other options too that we may have to consider. But hopefully that'll work.
Has this city grown or not since you put in there?
Not much. Within the city limits, and when I say that, I'm talking about the city itself, within the city limits. I don't know what it was when I started, probably 400, now it's 600, you know, in 20 years, that number, maybe. Percentage-wise, maybe it's been growth, I don't know. But in the surrounding area, there's been a lot of growth. Probably in the Cove community here, if you want to call it that, there's probably 2,000 people instead of just 600.
There's I've heard the faculty at the university chuckle that Cove was the faculty member of the internet. Quite a few of these questions put out there.
Yeah, I don't know how many, but a few do.
Actually, quite a few. I went through the directory.
Oh, did you?
Mexico. They had an address directory at the back of it, and I was amazed at how many live out this direction.
Well, it's a nice place to live, and basically, that's very typical because we are a bedroom community for LeGrand. We don't have any industry, and the water plant is as industrial as we get. And fortunately, that's a nice, clean industry, so it's good, but it only employs 4 or 5 people, I think. But that's the way we prefer it. I think most people here don't look for economic growth. I go to meetings of other cities in this area, and you know, they're always promoting how they're going to get industry to come in, or businesses, or whatever. And we really don't look for that. Somebody wants to open a business here, that's fine. I mean, you know, but we're not going out looking for them, because our economy is really tied to LeGrand.
So do the majority, probably the vast majority of people that are employed here in Cove are employed in LeGrand?
Yeah.
Can you tell me anything about when I first moved here, that about 14, 15 months ago, there was a major murder-suicide that took place here in Cove. Do you know about that? Do you have any
right across the street?
I knew it was right here in this particular neighborhood.
Yeah, and in fact, the man that was murdered was our city employee, public works there, and a good friend of ours. And his wife had died the spring before, and she was my wife's walking partner, and walked every morning. And so, yeah, we were very involved. And, know, it's just one of those unfortunate things where people are in the wrong place at the wrong time. And the couple that was involved, who lived across the street, had kind of a, you know, I'm trying not to get into personal things, you know, and I don't know the whole story, I don't even care to know the whole story, but their marriage had been off and on, you know, one had moved out, the other would move out, and that sort of thing. And our public works director was good friends with the couple. And in fact, she worked as a part-time employee of the city for a while. His would help him do his work, reading meters. When they split up, and they were, I don't think the divorce was finished, but when it was in the process, she had moved up to this other place up beyond the school there, and Abe happened to be at her house. Now, there's some rumors they were having an affair, whether that's their business, you know, they were both free to do that. All I know it was that he happened to be there that morning at 7 o'clock, and I know that that a lot of times he got up at 5 every morning and would do his rounds in the city, his style, and then he would go and have coffee with somebody. And I think that's probably what was going on. He stopped there and talked to her and had coffee. Well, her husband, her ex-husband, had planned this out, that he was going to go up there and shoot her. And of course, we don't know all the details because he killed himself, so we don't know what was going on. But we know that he built a barricaded himself in this house that was across the street on him. And because neighbors heard him building in there all night the night before. And he had barricaded a place in this one little room in this what was kind of a double wide trailer. And when he went up there do this, Abe was there, and Abe tried to stop him, and so he shot Abe. And meanwhile, she locked herself in the bedroom or wherever. So then he left and came down here, and the police came. And I was out of town, it was on a weekend, and I forget what I was doing, but I was out of town. So I was on the way back about Boardman, and my wife called me on the cell phone and said, told me the basics of what was going on. And when I got here, we couldn't even get to the house. We had police sharpshooters out the window here, and this window here that was right here where this door is now. Well, you probably read about the rest of the story where they knocked the building down practically to get at him and then found that he had committed suicide. Kathy stayed up with my mom's house, and I stayed down at my brother's house that night.
How long before you could get back to the home?
Oh, we were in the next day. It was quite an experience. I've never had that kind of thing happen. And generally, you know, very little of that kind of thing happens in the world. It's just a pretty laid back community. But it can happen anywhere.
Right. Has that changed anything about Cove?
Not that I can
tell. People still remain friendly and informal with each other.
I'm sure I know the family of the man who committed suicide was upset and thought the police could have handled it differently, but why wouldn't they? I mean, that's pretty natural. And in a community like this where both families are known and have friends and so on, but I never really heard of people taking sides so much. Most people just felt bad that it happened.
Does Cope have a police force of its own?
No.
Is it contracted out?
Yeah, we depend on the sheriff for the state police. It would bust our budget to have a police officer. It's expensive, but.
Mrs. Lurie is helpful with this, but are there things that are not here anymore that you see fairly institutional for Cope? They're missing from the landscape now.
Well, yeah, if you go back, she'd probably know a lot more than I do. Down across from the post office there, and down Orchard Street, there was a hotel there. And one time, in fact, one of my friends lived in that hotel when I was going to school at Sitzburg Down. And behind the post office was a flour mill. There's still remnants of it back there. Used to be a railroad that ran from here to Union. And came right up in front of the section school there.
Was that a freight train or a passenger?
Basically freight. In those days, you could probably ride the caboose or something. You know. Rattles. Huh? Lay down.
Do you remember the name of the flour mill?
It was gone.
Oh,
and then there was a boys' school up in that same area as the flour mill at one time, a high school type private school, same time that the girls' school was at Ascension. No.
Was that when you lived here also?
No. They had gone in the early 20s or 30s. That time. Back in the old days.
What are you going to do next?
Well, I've got several things that I'm doing. I'm still involved with my ministry, of course. And I have three usually running Studebakers that I work on regularly, and I say usually running because they all decided to die when I was involved in this project here and I had time working. But I do that, and I still substitute up at the school, and